I think that our education system here is falling behind others globally. We've latched on by what we do well, which is exam passes. We haven't looked enough at what's happening globally.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. William Butler Yeats, the great poet, observed, "Education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire." And whilst most would agree that education is the passport to a better future, how should we be thinking about education today and tomorrow? After 3 years of the Money Maze podcast, in which many of our guests have been armed with notable academic successes from a variety of institutions worldwide, we thought it overdue to examine the topic of education. Today, I hope we're going to discuss some of the important questions. How should we define a good education? How will AI influence both teaching and learning? Does the cost-benefit of private education and university education represent a good return on investment? Was Tony Blair simply wrong in his desire to have 50% of the UK population university educated? And how do we think about effecting change and defining great leadership? So to attempt this, we sought out one of the most distinguished and respected figures in the world of education, a headmaster who has achieved formidable success at Brighton College and then Wellington, successes and changes that would make any CEO celebrated by its shareholders, but also a former vice-chancellor of Buckingham University, the author of over 40 books, including his masterpiece, The Impossible Office, which examines 55 British prime ministers, and his most recent work, which includes an excoriating assessment of Boris Johnson's reign. He's acknowledged as one of the most respected headmasters of the last several decades, and someone with the unusual clarity of thinking and of execution, and is deputy chair of the Times Education Commission. So, Sir Anthony Seldon, historian, author, and educationalist, a very warm welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Hello.
As I read your book, The Impossible Obvious, you observed that former Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin and Neville Chamberlain always preferred face-to-face meetings, and to quote you, telephone was not their preferred method of transacting business. So with that as a precedent, there was no way I was going to let you do this remotely. And so here we are, late August, in our offices in Marylebone. So if we just jog back in time, you were born in Stepney, the youngest son of economist Arthur Seldon, who co-founded the Institute of Economic Affairs. How do you reflect on your upbringing?
Not enough, I think, is the answer. I think none of us reflect enough on our parents and where we've come from and what our hopes were. Our lives go by too quickly and without sufficient depth. So not enough, but my father, remarkable. The Economist and the obituary described him as the architect of Thatcherism and Blairism. Not bad for one poor Ukrainian boy born in Jewish East End of London.
So when one reads your academic successes, undergraduate degree from Oxford in PPE and a post-PhD in economics from the LSE and then an MBA, one thinks absolutely terrific. But I did read in the Times that when your A-level results arrived, they were greeted with horror. In fact, your quotation was, "I still remember the gloom that fell on the Seldon family home like a dark tarpaulin." What happened next?
Well, the tarpaulin remained rigidly in place for some time. And then it occurred to me that was a pretty dim way of living. And I decided to reset my A-levels at a school called Tunbridge in Kent. And first time I got two E's and a C. And the teachers were so surprised by the C that they wanted to get it remarked by the examiners because they were convinced it must have been a mistake and it really should have been an E also. And then I did reset and I did better second time round.
So you take these degrees, but at what point did you know you were set on an academic career?
I don't think I've ever been set on an academic career. I think life just happened. I'm interested in things, so power hugely interests me, and writing about Downing Street and getting inside the head of prime ministers and knowing them better often than they know themselves, as they, some of them would say. Interesting, worthwhile, important. I don't know. We're all interested, aren't we, in different things, and to be able to follow those interests all the way through to writing books about them. I'm now writing my 8th inside book on a consecutive prime minister, but that's not all I'm interested in. It wouldn't be enough. I don't think I could just have been an academic and spent my afternoons in committee meetings. There's hardly a committee meeting I've endured in my life that I've ever thought that was worthwhile. I'm talking there about the ones I've chaired. The others were often better, but we do spend too long in meetings. We often don't think clearly enough, what are we trying to achieve here? Do we really need to meet? Academics spend a lot of time in committee meetings, not enough with students. And I've loved my life. Look, I've spent it as a mixture of writing and teaching at uni and at schools and running the old school or other, but doing 101 other things that I love to do, the Royal Shakespeare Company, walking across Europe, creating this amazing new pathway and writing books about that. These are things that fascinate me, and the whole happiness agenda, the fact that we just waste our lives often beating ourselves up rather than discovering our own efficacy and making the most of our lives.
We're going to come back to a few of those, but let's just turn to education. And if you were explaining to someone who knew nothing about the UK's education system, how would you characterize it?
Well, I think Charles Dickens got it right in Hard Times. We have essentially, for all the superlative work that teachers, parents, and students themselves put in, it is fundamentally a 19th century model. It focuses on passive learners and the absorption of material that is then regurgitated in examination halls, much like it took place when schools really started spreading seriously in the 19th century. Indeed, some students are taking exams in exactly the same subjects, answering exactly the same questions, having been taught in exactly the same ways, and sitting the exams in exactly the same halls. So the world's moved on, and a lot of that is okay, but I think that our education system here is falling behind others globally. We've latched on by what we do well, which is exam passes. We haven't looked enough at what's happening globally. We have an incredibly insular education system at university and at school level. And we haven't looked enough at the way that society and the economy are changing and whether employers are content with the products coming out of schools, which categorically they're not.
So how do you judge and measure achieving an excellent education?
Well, how do we and how should we are two very different questions. So how do we? We look at people's performance at schools, particularly in Britain at GCSEs and A-level, sometimes for the imaginative schools and students, International Baccalaureate. And then we look at their classification at university and at the university they went to. And if it's Oxford, Cambridge, or Imperial, and a few others, that's great. And if they don't get into those places, it's not. And that's all wrong. So how we do look at it is different to how we should. So we are all born with a set of potentialities that we then nurture and develop in our life. We all have many different intelligences. The great Harvard educationalist said, don't ask a student how intelligent they are. Ask rather, how are they intelligent? And we're all intelligent in so many different ways in the world. At work, it doesn't matter if someone's got a triple A star in pure maths. Can they deliver a deal? Can they turn up in the morning at 9 a.m. or 6 a.m. sober? Can they get through a period of duress without shouting or without throwing sickies? That there are so many more ways to look at what it means to be an educated and contented person beyond the acquisition of exam success. Now, exam success might correlate with those things, but it often doesn't. A lot of people who've been spectacularly successful academically who are no good in politics, no good in creative business, no good in finance, insurance, law, accountancy, because it's not enough just to be very clever, very smart academically. You've got to have personality, the self-command to be able to leverage your intellectual intelligence with a whole set of other intelligences. And that's what I think we should be doing, to answer your question, better at school.
So within that is this concept of the immeasurables or the intangibles that schools should do. Now, you are known as an innovator. You developed a vision which you implemented at Brighton and Wellington, now at Epsom. But how did your vision for running a school change and evolve?
So the experience of running a school is tricky. Whatever school one is in, wherever in the world, there are expectations of one from governors, obviously, and reasonably, parents, ditto, but also a school system. And if you do not achieve the requisite number of top grades, then your school falls down league tables. And that puts an enormous amount of pressure on schools to move away from the individuality of the school towards a much more homogenized factory-based process whereby we are implanting this information within young people. We don't actually, although we might say we do, but we don't actually care very much or even know very much what happens to them after they leave us. I'm sure it's jolly nice when people come back on open days and shake our hands and tell us what a jolly time they're having, but we don't really care or think about building up the skills that they will need to be successful in life and not to have their life broken by mental or physical illnesses. We essentially just want to do the product. We deliver the product. And I think what I had to learn when running schools is that you can do all that. You can give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but you can also do much more than that. And by the way, if you do the other stuff really well, the kids will end up getting the same grades that they would do, but they'll be a whole lot more accomplished and rounded as human beings. So we reduce education to what can be measurable, but education is about much more clearly than that, and particularly for those people from lesser advantaged backgrounds where they didn't get another chance. There's not the social capital, the cultural capital at home to the same extent to have all your education, what's inside you, drawn out. And education, to remind your viewers and listeners, not that I need to do that with such an august body. Yes, everyone knows they're putting their hands up, but this is recorded, so I can't do anything about that. But big on you anyway, the word educate, which of course you all know what it means, don't you? By the way, I've never met an education secretary anywhere in the world that knows what the word means, seriously. But it means drawing out. It means leading out what's inside. So if you don't lead out what's inside, those things will remain dormant. Okay, so look, maybe you have natural affinity for, say, playing a musical instrument. Now, if you go to a posh school anywhere in the world, you will have more chance that that is developed. Or maybe you have a great aptitude at, it's just endless. We have 8 different intelligences, I think, which we could talk about, of which only 1 or 2 are measured by exams. And those, if they're not drawn out, they will remain dormant. And by the way, depression often comes where there is a sense that what you have inside you, you know that you have it, hasn't been valued by other people or identified, and it's a crying shame. And education should be doing much better at recognizing what's inside people and leading it out, as it says in the word. So to answer your question, what I learned was that you need to do more than this. You've obviously got to give the parents, the governors, the government, what it demands, their pound of flesh. But you can also give other things too, which will be enduring and of enduring value to those young people, which will last a lifetime, not just be a passport to get into university or get you your first job, after which people care much less about what grades you got on your CV. So I hope that I learned a little bit about how to do that, how to do the broader part of the piece.
And what are those other educations that you referred to?
Intelligences, really? Do you want to know those?
Yes.
So there's logical and linguistic intelligences. Now, they're very different and can be broadly defined by a breakdown between the science or STEM and the arts, humanities. And some of us can be more strong on logical, but less so on linguistic. Some of us can just be more intuitive about knowing things without quite knowing why we know them or why we're saying them. So those are measured to some extent by exams, but there are a lot of logical and linguistic intelligence that is not. But then given another pair, there is the personal intelligence, the intelligence to know how to live a meaningful, productive, happy life. Now, mucking your life up by snorting cocaine or by drinking too much or by chasing men or chasing women isn't intelligent. It really is not intelligent. It's stupid. It's wasteful of the potential that you've been given. And not exercising well or eating junk food isn't intelligent because it will shorten your life and it will diminish the quality of the life that you have. And with personal intelligence goes, I'm sitting quite hard there, by the way, social intelligence, the ability to be able to relate to people and understand people, to be empathetic, which is clearly very important, not just in one's working life, but in one's private life also. And then another pair is creative intelligence. Now, creativity can be nurtured. We all have creativity in us, and there are different aspects of it, which some more musical, some more bodily, movement, dance, acting, creative, emotion and writing, and visual art. But you want to have people in companies who are able to solve problems, who can see the potential there, not just to think in a grey box tick way. And with that goes physical intelligence. Look, sport is going to become more important throughout the 21st century. Not so much watching, although watching was clearly important, but playing, being involved in it ourselves. It's one of the great joys of life, going all the way back to ancient Greece and for millennia before that. And then two other intelligences are moral intelligence, the innate understanding of what is good and bad, what is right and wrong, what is truthful and what is untruthful, that is essential, again, both in our personal and in our corporate business lives. And then there's spiritual intelligence. Now, a lot of people will tell you that they've read Richard Dawkins or any other book and that that's all a load of crap. But what a sellout if one doesn't recognize that the spiritual is what makes life worthwhile for any professed atheist to understand this sense of awe and wonder. Seeing a sunset, seeing an extraordinary seascape, being in love, the love of one's children, the love of one's partner. We cannot define life in purely rational, logical ways, in sequential ways. To deny the irrational, that which itself is a pejorative word for what I'm talking about, there's that whole spiritual intelligence that some people are just, they're fantastic to be around. They just have extraordinary spiritual intelligence. So those are the eight intelligences which you asked for.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. So when I was talking to some parents whose children were there at Wellington when you were teaching, they said you broke with convention and introduced mental health lessons, teachings, understandings. What was the catalyst for that?
Recognizing that you could do it. Amazing American I came across and then have got to know very well from University of Pennsylvania called Martin Seligman, possibly the most important psychologist in the whole post-war period, who said that psychology is obsessed by what goes wrong. We ask endlessly, what's wrong with you? The doctor says, what goes wrong with you, your coach or your therapist, rather than asking a different question, which is, what's right with you? And what's going well? What goes well in your relationship? Not what goes wrong. Because if you concentrate on your relationship with what goes wrong, that then grows. What we give attention to grows. If we look at what goes right, then actually the stuff that's not going so well will be looked after and diminish anyway. So recognizing that there's this different way of looking and that we can have efficacy, we are able to choose our own fate. We are not self-determined. Tomorrow does not have to be like today just because today was like yesterday. If we think that we don't have efficacy, then we are hopeless. Nothing will change in our lives. And we can teach young people that they do have efficacy. And at the heart of all happiness is the ability to make people realize that they can be active decision makers. And they can do things like learning how to form good relationships. Yeah, some people, lucky them, just can do it naturally. But actually, you can understand how you develop a relationship. Here's one how. Active, constructive engagement. Your child comes in from school or you see them in the holidays having a chat. You ask them a question and you then lose interest in what they say. Active, constructive engagement means that you're interested in what they say and you're constructively engaging with it in a way that is drawing them out. We all love to be drawn out about our good experiences. It's extraordinarily fundamental in building good relationships. And by the way, being stuck at home with everyone just on their mobile phones, for example, over dinner is not the way to bring up a kid. And we should rightly be very worried about children in 20, 30 years' time who've been brought up with mums and dads who are on mobile phones and they're not engaging. The phone is the closest thing that we have to a great asset like AI, but it's also an enormous downturn also. The family meal table is the equivalent. It's a secular church or temple or mosque. It's the great place that we can all come to engage actively with each other. We can learn how to live more happy, meaningful lives. Exercise. A lot of kids will do a lot of exercise when they're at school and they go up to uni. Certainly universities in Britain, unlike universities in North America and elsewhere, where there's much more focus on sport, there isn't very much focus on sport. You've got to be looking for it. At schools, the sport comes to you. And for their mental health of young people to have the fun, the teamwork, the ability to forget your life because you're just immersed in the game, all that exercise is incredibly valuable. And the kids go up to uni, they're not doing that anymore, and they start developing enormous mental problems. There's so many things that we can learn about how we can have agency and how we can make good decisions in our life that will make us happy.
That's beautifully expressed. I want to just laser in on effecting change. You, as we know, led and changed two schools, Brighton and Wellington, particularly Wellington, which many of us who are of a certain age, when you took over, it would not have been described as best in class. It is today. In your book, Assessing Prime Ministers, The Impossible Office, you talk about the substructural forces, i.e. other factors that help determine success or failure, which is equally applicable to headmasters or CEOs. Now, a friend, Jonathan Glassberg, who's a governor at Clifton College, asked me, could you have succeeded at Wellington 20 years earlier or at a more obscure and less well-situated school?
So this is a point about all leadership, that the successful prime ministers, like the successful CEOs or heads of divisions in big corporations, have to realize what is possible. And most prime ministers achieve little, and most are disappointing because they don't have a realistic understanding of what they can achieve. So the situational point is there. And the great prime ministers, like the great presidents of the United States, for example, are there at moments of great change. So if you are not there at a moment, a war or an epidemic or a major economic downturn, it is harder to achieve greatness because the spotlight doesn't home in on you in the same way. Same with vice chancellors and heads of schools, heads of any organization. You just need to know what is there, what the potential is, and make the most of the situation that you have. So I think at Wellington, like at Brighton, I was lucky because both those institutions were ripe for significant change. I then went and ran a university, University of Buckingham, which didn't have the resources to make the change. It had a sense that it needed to change, but it didn't have that same general agreement across it. It was just less evident about what needed to be done. So making transformational change there was harder. Not everyone can be a transformational leader. It has more to do with the events around you and the resources available at the time. And it begs the question that are great leaders made by great events much more than do they make great events? Churchill, for example, was a failure before May 1940 in many ways, not just in the First World War, but when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer and in his foreign policy ideas in the 1930s. But he was a magnificent prime minister during the war, and I have argued after the war also. So situational. Yeah, I think the answer to your friend is we underestimate because we don't see the substructure. And by the way, you look at prime ministers today and some people, like to some extent Rishi Sunak, prime minister of Britain at the moment in 2023, there's very little he can achieve because he's very likely to lose, not definitely, but he will achieve something no prime minister has achieved since 1832, which is when modern British democracy was first formed, which is to win five general elections for one party on the trot. It just hasn't been done, doesn't mean it can't be done. But people will look at him and they expect, there's an article in the Financial Times this very week, denigrating him. Sorry, you know, his ability to make that transformational change was very slight. And that would be true of people going to offices in whatever sphere, corporate, business, finance, professional services, whatever.
So let's talk about AI. In 2018, you were early in advancing that discussion. You authored that book, The Fourth Education Review. You wrote, "We have allowed ourselves to believe that teaching can uniquely be done only by the teacher, but might it in fact be better carried out by AI machines or at least in concert with teachers?" So as you're looking ahead, how do you think AI might change both teaching and learning?
AI is the biggest thing to hit education since the printing press. And we don't yet fully understand that. We are working out how AI is changing work, and we are still educating people for a pre-AI world. Many of the most logical jobs will be done by machines. We are teaching people for the very skills, logical, intense intellectual activity that the AI, the algorithms will always be able to outperform the human being on. We need to start teaching people human intelligence rather than machine intelligence. But at the moment, we're teaching them essentially machine intelligence. So AI is changing the world of work before our eyes and the society before our eyes. And that's what our education system is not yet geared up to. We still have an industrial revolution style education system, but it's also, we're not embracing the way that it will do the heavy lifting. So AI will help every facet of a teacher's job, the preparation of the material, so that it's relevant to the individual student, presenting it to the student in a personalized way, mindful of them and how they're responding. The AI will be responding and see that the individual students on certain days, certain times a day are not responding well. They'll represent it. They'll give a quality of personalized attention that any one teacher, however brilliant, can never do. They'll also give formative assessment, which means assessment that is forming that child's student's progress in real time, not having to wait for a couple of weeks. You get a few ticks at the end, mark that it's meaningless. It will enormously help students to learn, but it'll still be the need for the same number of teachers. It will free up the heavy lifting of teaching, the preparation, the administration of teaching and the marking for teachers to be far more able to develop the human skills in young people. It will also mean that the idea that schools are places that we have physical boundaries, and you come into the school and there's a sign on the front of the school and you go up to the door and in you go, and then there are physical classrooms. It's just ridiculous. I mean, does anyone believe that stuff anymore? Students can get better lessons on physics or history often through AI, and if they can't already, they certainly will in 10 years' time. And we need to be doing more to prepare ourselves, our young people, for that world.
And as you, because you have experience in all sorts of other theatres of operation in terms of education, from China to Saudi Arabia, is anybody sufficiently ahead of this evolution that we should be looking to them and learning?
Well, they are. I mean, there's a lot happening in China, worryingly. And there's a lot happening in countries in South Africa and in Brazil and in Uruguay and in the Baltics. So Britain has been slow. AI remains, as when I wrote that book 6 years ago, it remains the Cinderella aspect of AI. We're doing well on AI comparatively and understanding its impact in healthcare, diagnosis, in operations. Good on AI in legal work, in a whole range of mining, extractive industries, service industries, retail, but not very good at AI in education. And I do think the British government needs to catch up, and it's partly because it is fixated on its exam obsession, which, by the way, is very good at failing a lot of people. And the people it fails are not the kind of young people who go to the schools where I've been head of, but it is those from disadvantaged backgrounds who simply can't get their heads around or haven't got the encouragement at home, or often they have, or they haven't got the quiet, they haven't got the resources at home to keep up and compete in the same way with others.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. We're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by Bordeaux Index, and I'd like to briefly share a few details about Live Trade, their market-leading fine wine trading platform. Did you know over the last 5 years, some of the most prudent investments weren't in gold or stocks, crypto or fixed income? They were in bottles. Live Trade is the place to start buying and investing in fine wine, with the platform showing instant and transparent bid and offer quotes on the world's most sought-after wines. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Burgundy, Italy, and other top wine regions. With 24/7 updated two-way pricing and instant liquidity, there are no hidden fees or membership costs. While the finest case of Bordeaux can be aged for up to 50 years, it can now be sold in an instant with Live Trade. Discover more at bordeauxindex.com/livetrade. So let's talk about excellence and cost and benefits. We're talking about an independent sector which is only 7% of the UK teaching system and becoming increasingly unattainable given the price of education. Price of fees has gone up a multiple of inflation over the last 3 decades. How are you thinking about that unaffordability and what it does to the teaching landscape?
There is no more important way that one can, as a parent, look after one's children than their education. It doesn't mean you have to pay for the education. Sometimes better schools in any country will be the state-funded, public-funded schools rather than private schools. Private schools have gone up in real terms enormously, the fees over the last 50 years, and many parents' ability to pay has not gone up. And it's a crushing burden on many parents who are making enormous sacrifices. Nobody is able to grab the reins and say, this is ridiculous. Sometimes people stand up and say we shouldn't be letting our school fees go up this much, but they will carry on going up as long as people will pay. So in those schools that have boarding spaces, there are sufficient numbers, not least from Russia and China and elsewhere, to pay for those places. China also massively underpins the whole university sector. And as long as people are able to pay, even if it is putting unfair pressure on the British middle class parent, they will carry on going up. It is unfair. it is wrong somehow, and yet nobody has been able to solve it and to get a grip. What would it mean? It would mean that cut price schools would come in, but they haven't been able to do that successfully. London, in particular, suffers from the fact that you can't get premises that would in any way compete with the big existing independent schools. And even if one could earn a big income from the fees, if it was going to be more manageable economically to do it, then many more people would have started up, and that would have brought the fees down because of new competition. There are some brave examples of people who have succeeded, but new competition in London, as elsewhere, hasn't really come into the sector. So it's just meant that the fees have continued to go up and up. There are more teachers, probably more teachers than we absolutely need. And there are more and better facilities, probably more and better than we absolutely need. So it goes on.
So one of the things as we move towards university discussion now is this issue that there are expectations. Some of them are unrealistic of people who pay those fees about the academic institution that they think is nirvana, often very mistaken and I think disappointing. But there is, of course, the leveling up, rebalancing, whatever you want to call it, where white privileged boys and girls are being excluded from universities they might have attended. And a significant, as you know, from Epsom, and we all observe, big brain drain to the US universities that have significant appeal. Now, we're going to talk, as I said, about these UK universities and why they might be disappointing, but is there a better way of resolving this ambition to level up than the one which is underway?
So governments in Britain have tried for 100 years to level up ever since the 1920s, when it was an avowed aim of government policy, recognizing that there's a prosperous southeast dominated by London and the rest of the country, which did well during the Industrial Revolution. As global competition increased, those areas and the industries and services that they were majoring on went into comparative decline. So Britain has a huge problem with leveling up, and no government successfully has been able to address it in a sustained way for all the comparative success for the Birminghams and Manchesters. And there is pressure also, as you say, on, quite rightly so, on universities to admit young people who come from less advantaged backgrounds and to give them preferential grade offers to compensate for the fact they have come from a disadvantaged background. And that is absolutely right that that happens, because universities should be assessing potential, not ability on entry. But no one needs to panic unduly, because this year, 2023, where there was enormous gloom about independent school and middle-class children being squeezed out by both overseas students who pay universities a lot more money, but also squeezed out by government policy putting pressure on universities to take those from less advantaged background. For all that, the great majority of young people from middle-class backgrounds have managed to get university offers at universities they want. Looking at university in America, it's an enormously attractive opposition, obviously, depending on the university, where there are vast numbers of vastly different quality and type. But the top universities do offer a lot more than British universities. So a child comes out of school where maybe their parents are paying 45,000 a year, and they can be a little bit surprised by the comparatively spartan existence of life at university, where they're maybe paying 10,000 a year, because there's simply much less money. 50 years ago, there was much less difference. Independent schools were far more spartan places. They were far less aware of the difference. So it's not really fair to universities for young people to say the accommodation is comparatively poor and there are not great opportunities as there were at my school for the arts and sports, which will be certainly true for all but the elites at those universities. And maybe the teaching quality and certain teaching numbers is nothing like as good. All those things will be true. And the more affluent and better resourced British independent education has become, the more of a slight bump it appears, unless you are lucky enough to go to Oxford and Cambridge, where the numbers, as everyone knows, independent school young people going has declined rapidly and will probably continue to decline.
So you were Vice-Chancellor at Buckingham University from 2015 to 2020. And going back through one of Tony Blair's early aspirations was setting a target of 50% of young adults to go into higher education. Was that just profoundly misguided?
Well, I don't think it was, because I think a university, and this is a nuanced answer to it, university is an extraordinary experience for young people. And properly lived, it is life-enhancing and life-changing. But I think far too many, that said, this is the nuanced bit, go to university without thinking, why on earth they're doing it? It's just a treadmill. So they're going to Exeter because that's where their mates are going. They haven't really thought, what am I going to get out of Exeter? What do I want to achieve there? What am I going to be doing to really make the most of opportunities? It just happens like on a treadmill. So I would much sooner have a system whereby more people were going to university overall, but those people who were able intellectually and personally to benefit from it, but not those who just see university as just as an opportunity for getting stoned or wasted every night, which actually is not going to help them one bit, and they'll come out after 3 years far worse equipped to cope with the world than if they hadn't had that experience. So I think Blair was right. He was thinking of all those people who have those capabilities to go to university, who are unable under the present dispensation 20 years ago, but everyone needs to think about it. And it's not right for everybody. And there are two-year degrees, Buckingham for some, who just want to race through it. There are four-year degrees in Scotland. There are universities abroad. All this going straight into work, and maybe in your late 20s to a open university degree when you feel ready for it. You don't have to go to university. Nobody has to go to university.
So I suppose I'd take slight issue with that. According to research by the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development I was reading, 36% of graduates in the UK are overqualified for the jobs they hold. And back in 1992, for example, 3% of all bar staff had degrees. Today it's nearly 20%. 2% of security guards had degrees. Now it's 24%. And that doesn't seem to serve either the students or society itself. And apprenticeships, which have been flat in the UK for a decade, are viewed very differently than if you look at the German model, where you might go to a respected company like Siemens and after a while obtain important qualifications and you're highly regarded. I think there is some irony that Tony Blair's son's business Multiverse is pursuing that exact apprenticeship aim. And you didn't know, but my daughter just finished at Exeter University, and to say it was underwhelming would be a euphemism. And we had Niall Ferguson on the show a while back, and he said what has happened below the top handful of UK universities is profoundly disappointing in terms of contact teaching hours, in terms of the quality of the education, and so forth. So this leads me to bring both school and university education together with this question. If you were Minister for Education, what would be on the top of your list?
Well, I think education does need more money, and it does need to be using AI much more systematically. Britain should be leading the world. It does need to be embedding good mental health and good all-round multiple intelligence development of young people, including character development. And universities, rather than the government wasting a lot of political capital, I think attacking them over woke this and woke that, actually start ensuring that they really are teaching better, the learning quality is better. But at the end of the day, they don't have a lot of money for each child. And if you have had the privilege of going to a great independent school or maybe a great state school where the teaching will be as good, but there won't be the same per capita spending, it is a bump down. I'm not even certain that below Oxford and Cambridge, even in those universities like Durham and St. Andrews that people aspire to, that there is such more of a difference. I think there's an enormous difference in Oxford and Cambridge and the rest, but students can go to great cities and have an incredible time. That is still a wonderful experience, but they just need, as I was saying earlier, when you were asking about the mental health and what's the key to it, and it's agency, young people need to go and not be surprised. They need to know it. It's no bad thing if it's comparatively Spartan compared to school. Hello, that's what life is going to be like. They're going to be living probably not like mum and dad. This is the first generation, as we keep on hearing, whose standard of living will not be better on average than mum and dad, and get used to it. And actually having a fantastically palatial house and holidays and cars is no necessary ingredient about leading a good or a meaningful or a happy life. But the quality of teaching at universities is a concern, as is the contact hours. But young people need to know that in advance. And to be honest, it's not going to change dramatically.
So some closing questions. One on leadership, because you've effected change and you wouldn't say it, but have been regarded as a very effective leader. In your most recent book on Boris Johnson, and I have to just skip a quote here, it's historic because of the extraordinary lack of respect for convention and the Constitution. He thought he could make up his own rules, but in the end he found he couldn't. He ran out of oxygen. He went on and on defying gravity. And in the end, he fell from the sky. That's one of, I think I'm right in saying, 57 British prime ministers. Who in that collection of prime ministers was, in your opinion, the greatest leader and why?
So I pick out 9 leaders out of the 57 that have now been up to Rishi Sunak. I can do the same with American presidents, but let's concentrate on British prime ministers. So there's a strike rate of about 1 in 8. Who really have made the weather, made a difference, made history, left the office, the country different in a better way after than it was before. And they have various similarities. We take the point that some of it is situational. If you come in with a big majority, or if you come in with a lot of money, it's much easier than if you come in without a majority, or if you come in at a time of great recession. But those who have succeeded have had clear agendas. Those who succeed as CEOs will have clear agendas. And it's remarkable that many prime ministers haven't. We do not know what the agenda was of many prime ministers. They come in, they're very good at winning elections, but they're not very good at governing, and they're different skills. They are unwilling to learn from history. They don't know about history. They know less history and less about politics than most politics and history A-level students will. They're surrounded by advisors who are high on energy but know nothing about how to be prime minister. They sack the people like Boris Johnson and Liz Truss who can tell them how to run the outfit because they assume erroneously that they are malign or invested with the predecessor. And they're awful. And they underperform, and it's not good enough to underperform as a prime minister. As prime minister, you have the most powerful job in the country. You have a duty bound to do your best. So it's quite a sorry story. Britain hasn't had a landmark prime minister since Margaret Thatcher left nearly 25 years ago, incredibly. That's a long time.
3 closing questions. If you could have dinner with one figure from history, who would it be?
William Pitt, the younger, not so well known by many, but the prime minister who took over when he was 24, left office dead age 46, was the second longest serving prime minister in British history. He was prime minister at the time of the Napoleonic Wars, similar mission, therefore, to Winston Churchill. But, you know, Churchill would be not a bad dinner guest if Pitt was busy that night.
In terms of dealing with resilience, you have written this book inspired by a soldier, The Path of Peace, as you dealt with your own tragedy. What advice do you offer to people who are asking about overcoming grief?
Accept it, embrace it. You have to know that grief, where there's love, there'll always be grief. Grief is the price we pay for love, as someone famously said. It's inevitable. What you can do is not let yourself be defined by it. Say Queen Victoria did after she lost her beloved Prince Albert in 1861. And there's no point in making yourself miserable and other people around you. You know, you have children, you have employees, you have family, you have yourself, you have a duty to move on. It doesn't honour the person who is no longer on earth if you make yourself miserable.
You were described once as being restlessly ambitious. What is still out there that you want to summit?
Well, I quite fancy playing centre forward for England, and I have been honing my skills. So I think that is, look, I don't want to be immodest, but I think that is definitely something that's on the cards coming up. I just want to be the best possible father, best possible husband. Look, to take one thing, as well as creating the Museum of the Prime Minister, which I'm passionate about doing, it is creating this path all the way to Ukraine, the path of peace. So I've read about it in the book called The Path of Peace Along the Western Front. defining a path, which is 1,000 kilometers, takes 1,000,000 paces through soil where 10 million casualties. Incredible. I think we all need to take time out in our lives. Best imaginable advice to everybody listening, watching, is take time out, because it's never wasted. As we were beginning, when you asked about reflection, reflect more on your life. Very few of us can truthfully say that we have lived the life, or we are living the life, that is the best possible life that we can live. And many of us are malaligned in our life. We don't give enough time to those things that really matter to us, including our health and our family, but also our values. And we suddenly have a shock and it pulls us up short and we realize, what's happened? Go on a pilgrimage, go on a long walk. Now, switch this off, turn it off, pack up, turn out the light and set out wherever. Walk the Camino, walk the Western Front way, look it up, and just rework or find your own path, for goodness sake, and meet incredible people who are so different to the people you are seeing day after day, week after week, year after year, and rework your life, rethink it. You will never regret it. That's what I did in that book. And that quest goes on all one's life. But if I can then create this next path, the next path I'm walking from kilometer zero in the Swiss border, which is where the trenches ended, up through the Rhine to the Black Forest and across Germany, and then Czechoslovakia, and finishing in Auschwitz, and writing a book called The Path to Light, looking at those people as I'm walking along in those communities who did good things to resist tyranny. How many of us would stand up? How many of us know? Look at the dictators who are striding across the world increasingly. Is there any guarantee that we're going to have a democratic president in America? Look at what's happening and think about one's ability to stand up for what we think is true and know is true. That's what that path's about. We've all got our own stories. The Thoreau, the American writer, said most men and women lead lives of quiet desperation and go to their graves with their song still inside them. Go to their graves with their song still inside them. And that's exactly true. And it doesn't have to happen. I go to funeral after funeral where, of course, people are bigged up about everything they've done, but actually inside were in a yearning that that person didn't actually truly find their song glorious when they have. Whatever your song is in life, every single person has a song. And our job is not to lead a life of quiet desperation and accumulating success, but find that inner song which is unique to you, has your name on it.
So normally I summarize with some of the particularly salient observations. There are so many in there. I'm just going to encourage our listeners to listen to this podcast twice. It's been terrific having you. Thank you for giving us your time and for sharing your wisdom.
Thanks, Simon, for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.